Welcome Chief Judge Young of the Southern District of Indiana, who's sitting with us today. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Our first case of the morning is EEOC against Management Hospitality of Racine. Mr. McKellar.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Robert Milek. I represent the defendants' appellants in this case. This class action sexual harassment case was brought by the EEOC on behalf of two claimants.
Class action?
Yes, Your Honor. It was started as a class action.
The only party. There's no class certified here.
No, there's not, but they titled
it's not a class action.
Well, it's not. I would agree with you. It's brought on behalf of two claimants, initially three, and one didn't show for the trial, so it was reduced to two claimants.
No, there's just one plaintiff. The plaintiff is the EEOC.
I agree.
This is a suit by the federal government.
Yes. It was brought on behalf of the two claimants, alleging sexual harassment at an IHOP restaurant located in Racine, Wisconsin. The owner and operator of the restaurant is Management Hospitality of Racine, or MHR, that was owned by the other defendant, Sal Jan Muhammad, who is the sole shareholder and owner of that restaurant. This case is somewhat unique because the EEOC amended their pleadings to include naming Flip Me a Stack, Inc., a management consultant company, as liable for the sexual harassment at the restaurant under the theory that it was an integrated enterprise and citing Papa versus Katie for the proposition that Flip Me a Stack, who created the policy that allegedly failed at this restaurant, was really responsible for the sexual harassment. The case went to trial in November of 2009. The jury returned a verdict in favor of the EEOC on the claims of sexual harassment, but against them on a claim of retaliation against one of the claimants. This appeal followed. On appeal, we raised seven principal issues. The first four really relate to Flip Me a Stack, Incorporated, and whether or not it can be held liable under any theory of liability brought by the EEOC and then raised sua sponte by the trial judge following the trial and following the post-trial briefing. Those are whether or not it can be liable, whether or not there should be an injunction issued against Flip Me a Stack, whether the trial court could aggregate the workforces of the client restaurants that it provides management consulting to, and whether punitive damages should ever lie against Flip Me a Stack or even MHR. We also raised some evidentiary issues with the court with regard principally to the admission of other acts evidence regarding other allegations of sexual harassment that didn't involve these claimants. We submit to the court that the admission of that evidence was prejudicial and should not have been allowed. We also raised the issue of whether or not the special verdict form in this case should have included the defendant's affirmative defense, which it did not. Therefore, the jury was never able to consider whether or not the defendants proved its affirmative defense in this case, which is a hallmark of Title VII compliance. Finally, we raised the issue of whether or not MHR can even be held liable for sexual harassment, because we submit that the evidence is clear and uncontroverted that there was no severe and pervasive sexual harassment, and even if there were, the defendants acted reasonably to correctly and promptly correct any sexual harassment, and that the claimants failed to take advantage of the ability to seek relief in any form whatsoever. Turning first to the issue of the liability of Flip Me a Stack, Inc. Flip Me a Stack, as I said, is a management consulting company. It's charged with...
That's how it describes itself, but the district court said and also concluded that the jury could find it was not a management consulting company. It was instead a management company.
Yes, Your Honor.
It didn't consult and tell somebody else how to do their management. It actually did the management.
Well, that's...
Why is that something that no reasonable jury could find?
Well, because first of all, the trial court found that Flip Me a Stack was liable based upon the control theory of liability.
The trial court didn't find this. The jury found this. The trial court said that there was sufficient evidence to support a jury verdict. Now, the question is, why would that be erroneous? It doesn't have anything to do with what we would find or what the trial court found, but the sufficiency of the evidence for the jury, because this is the result of a jury trial.
Actually, no, that's not correct. There was no jury finding. The issue of liability for...
There are no jury findings on a lot of issues. This is a subject on which your brief is confused, but on a general verdict, all the subsidiary issues are assumed to be resolved. You don't need special verdicts on every issue.
I would agree with that, but the issue of liability for Flipmeastack was to be decided by the trial court after the verdict by the jury. That was specifically carved out by the trial court to be determined. There was a brief prior to the trial in motions in limine by the EEOC where it was suggested that Papa versus Katie was controlling. And under Seventh Circuit precedent, the issue of whether or not to pierce the corporate veil is to be decided by the trial court after the trial. The court agreed. The parties reserved that issue for post-trial consideration. And the bottom line here, Your Honor, is that the control theory was never raised by the commission at any time before, during, and after this trial. Therefore, the defendants had no opportunity whatsoever to present any evidence on this issue. We were completely blindsided by a sua sponte ruling by the trial court post-verdict. If we had known that this was going to be an issue, we certainly would have presented a lot of evidence showing the fact that Flipmeastack does not control the day-to-day activities of these employees. In fact, the evidence that we were able to get into the record by just simply presenting the basic facts to address Papa versus Katie and give the jury a background demonstrated that they did not control the day-to-day activities of these employees. The evidence is uncontroverted that MHR had a general manager and two assistant managers. They were responsible for controlling the day-to-day activities of these employees. They set their schedules. They hired them. They ensured that the sexual harassment videotape was played to them. They fired employees. They did not control the day-to-day activities of these employees. So even if you look at the evidence that was presented, you cannot make a conclusion that they controlled the day-to-day activities. Indeed, Flipmeastack's representative, who was the district manager for that particular Racine restaurant, was in the restaurant only two times per month to check on how things were going. By definition, you can't have control of day-to-day activities when someone's only there twice a month. So that's the unusual posture of this case, is that this issue was raised.
I don't understand that at all. Corporations are liable for the acts of their subordinates, even if the CEO has never been in a restaurant.
Well, but the district manager was not employed by MHR. The district manager was employed by Flipmeastack.
Look, there's a separate question about whether these are a joint employer. Right? That's a kind of question that in labor law gets raised all the time. Whether or not this issue was reserved for decision by the district judge, our standard of review is clear error under Rule 52. You still haven't tried to explain why there was a clear error committed, as opposed to just stating your view about what the judge should have done.
Well, I believe that the clear error is the judge raising the sua sponte. It wasn't identified as an issue. And under the Seventh Circuit precedent, including the Bertzel case that we mentioned in the brief, trial courts can't raise new theories of liability after the trial on their own. You have to give the parties the opportunity to present their arguments. And by doing that, that's clear error. You can't come up with a new theory that we haven't had any opportunity to present facts on. We've been blindsided by that. That, I would suggest, that is the clear error here. Judge Adelman made a clear error by raising an issue that had never been briefed by the parties.
Didn't the facts that were developed at trial, didn't they justify that question go to the jury with the control? It appears to me that Flipmeastack exercised a lot of control over how these restaurants were run and who ran them.
Well, first, to answer your first part of your question, no. We did not know this was going to be an issue. We would have certainly presented a lot of testimony about the controlled issues to demonstrate that they didn't control the day-to-day activities. They were not responsible for the financial operation of MHR. They didn't fund the operation of MHR. They didn't do the payroll of MHR. They were completely separate and distinct companies.
They provided all the training.
They provided
the
training.
Employees.
I'm sorry.
And isn't that what we're talking about here in a sexual harassment situation, is training?
Well, certain aspects of operation of this restaurant were controlled and run by Flipmeastack. And the important ones for this appeal, such as the sexual harassment training, And this court has recognized in other cases, such as Papa versus Katie, which is the leading case on integrated enterprise, and that theory, is that companies can routinely spin off operations to a consulting company, such as accounting or sexual harassment training, and that does not mean that the parent company or an affiliated company controls.
But as Judge Easterbrook mentioned, this is not, FlipMe Stack was not a consulting company.
It is a consulting company.
It may be a consulting company here, but what they did was certainly not consulting. They were managing.
Well, they managed the aspects of the sexual harassment compliance. There's no doubt about that. That was their role here, and they did it effectively. In fact, I think when you look at the situation here, FlipMe Stack acted as a fail-safe for MHR. In case there was a breakdown in the implementation of its sexual harassment policy, FlipMe Stack is available and is charged with the duty of making sure that complaints are received and followed up on. And the facts of this case are overwhelming that in fact occurred. FlipMe Stack was the fail-safe. It's undisputed here that FlipMe Stack created a policy. It was in written form. The sexual harassment videotape was shown to every employee and admitted by the complainants that they had seen and observed the sexual harassment videotape, and that was understandable. It's undisputed that they signed off on the policy, that they knew who to complain to. It's undisputed that telephone numbers were conspicuously posted in the restaurant for them to make complaints to their assistant manager, to their general manager, to FlipMe Stack, and to corporate IHOP. Those facts are undisputed. It's also undisputed that they knew that Steve Smith, the district manager for FlipMe Stack, was the go-to guy for complaints of sexual harassment and that he was in the restaurant and accessible by these complainants to make a complaint to. Those facts are undisputed. What's more, it's undisputed that as soon as Steve Smith heard rumors that there was a private investigator looking into allegations of sexual harassment, he took it upon himself to go up to Ms. Powell and ask her, have you heard about this? Do you know anything about this? He initiated the complaint process. That's undisputed. He then initiated an investigation by interviewing as many servers as he could find. It's also undisputed that he took written statements and then made a reasonable conclusion based upon his investigation that the policy had been violated. What's more, he also concluded that the general manager, Michelle Dahl, did not apparently relay these complaints of sexual harassment to him in a timely fashion, which is a violation of the policy. He then concluded that as a result of her violation of the policy, she should be fired and carried out the firing of Ms. Dahl. That sent a strong message to every employee that this policy is taken very seriously and it will be enforced with dire consequences. So the policy from top to bottom, Your Honors, was followed in this case.
You're just proceeding as if we were a jury. You're not engaging with the standard of review. I've asked you several times to do that. It really is in your interest to do so.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe I'm addressing the FlipMe Stack standard of review because I believe it's clear error by the court to raise it sua sponte.
That much you've made clear.
Yes, thank you. And so turning to the next theory that the EEOC had raised, the Papa versus Katie theory, even if this court were to look at, well, let me step back for a minute. Looking at the control test, I believe that the facts that were even managed to get into the record do not support such a finding. As I indicated before, FlipMe Stack wasn't responsible for any of the costs of the operation of MHR. It didn't manage the day-to-day supervision of the employees there. So under the Knight test, there are insufficient facts to establish that there was control here. Turning next to Papa versus Katie, which is the theory that was brought forward by...
Did you try the case?
I did.
Did you argue to the jury that there was no control?
No. None of these theories were argued to the jury. This was all to be decided by the trial court after the jury verdict in post-trial motions. That was the set out, the plan that was established by the trial court and not objected to by the EEOC or the defendants. And so we were to present all of, there was nothing to prevent us from providing evidence into the record post-trial about the Papa versus Katie factors. That was the identified theory of liability. So that's what the parties did. We argued integrated enterprise and Papa versus Katie. The control theory was never raised at any time. In fact, the words control theory don't even appear in any of the post-trial briefs by the EEOC or the defendants. It was just simply never raised. So that, Your Honor, I believe is clear error for a trial court to raise a theory sua sponte. We simply had no opportunity to present those facts.
That's more dangerous than that.
Turning next to Papa versus Katie, the EEOC urged two factors that the trial court could rely on to find Papa versus Katie applied. The first one was piercing the corporate veil. Now, the trial court found that FlipMeStack and MHR are separate and distinct entities, and therefore there was no facts to support a finding of piercing the corporate veil. The third factor, which was argued by the EEOC, was that FlipMeStack directed a discriminatory act. Now, we submit to you that that's clear error, because directing a discriminatory act, as we understand that factor under Papa versus Katie, is when a parent or an affiliated corporation commands another affiliated company or a subsidiary to do the discriminatory act. For example, in Papa versus Katie, the adverse action was the termination of an individual older than 40. As a result, the parent company actually directed the act. Here, the trial court concluded that FlipMeStack directed a discriminatory act because the policies that it had put in place allegedly failed. Now, I think that's, under the facts, that's a misinterpretation and legal error to interpret that factor that way. You have to show that the parent company, FlipMeStack, would have directed either Gutierrez, the alleged harasser, to take action or someone to ignore those complaints. And there was no evidence that FlipMeStack had directed anyone to do either of those things. So the third factor in Papa simply wasn't present in this case. Furthermore, we don't believe that Papa versus Katie applies in this case. Papa versus Katie stands for the proposition that an employee may vitiate the tiny employer defense when the entity itself has less than 15 employees, the threshold for Title VII liability. Papa versus Katie is allowed to vitiate that defense by saying, yes, even though you have less than 15 employees, you're really just an arm of this parent company, and we can aggregate your workforces. So I don't believe that Papa versus Katie even applies in this manner. And so that was an error of law to be even considered in this case. However, even if the court does find, and it has, as I pointed out in our principal brief in Worth versus Tire, there was a comment that it may not just be limited to the situation, but I believe in reading Papa, it is limited to the tiny employer defense situation. But even if you apply it here, those factors are not met. We also believe that it was a clear error for the trial court to enter a broad, sweeping injunction against FlipMeStack. The court found that FlipMeStack and all of its client restaurants should be enjoined in this case. We believe that's clear error because there is no possibility that there will be additional sexual harassment against these claimants. Indeed, Ms. Schisler and Ms. Powell, the claimants, they do not work for MHR. They don't work for FlipMeStack, and there's no possibility they could be sexually harassed. I see that my light is on. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Bruner.
May it please the court. My name is Paula Brunner, and I'm representing the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the appellee in this case. Just to begin with, the defendants cannot meet its burden of establishing that the district court or the jury erred in finding for the EEOC on the sexual harassment claim. So unless there are no questions with respect to the issues undergirding the sexual harassment claim and the affirmative defense, I would like to move to FlipMeStack's liability and why this court should affirm the liability finding. On the issue of liability, the EEOC has always maintained that FlipMeStack was a common employer to be held jointly and severably liable along with MHR and Mr. John Muhammad.
Is that a jury issue?
It became a post-trial.
Hold on. Was it a jury issue?
It was not a jury issue, Your Honor. It was an issue decided after trial by the district court judge. And in so doing, the district court judge entertained all of the facts that had been presented by the commission as to why Flip Mia Stack should be held accountable and was a proper defendant in this Title VII action. One of those issues was that...
Is it the usual method of the EEOC to have the bifurcated so the judge decides liability after the jury has returned a verdict?
That was not a decision of the EEOC, Your Honor. We actually presented this issue pre-trial. It was also decided by the judge that it would be ruled upon post-trial. So
it was a judicial decision to rule on it post-trial. Normally, it would be part of the trial.
And it was, Your Honor. A lot of facts were presented during the course of the trial to establish.
To the jury? All those
to the jury, yes, Your Honor.
And did they rule on it?
No, Your Honor, because the judge decided that that determination would be handled by him post-trial.
Here's what I'm also... I admit it's been a while since I tried a lawsuit all by myself, but there you are. I thought we presented all the matters to the jury, let them make this decision on the factual findings. That didn't happen in this case?
No, Your Honor.
That's unusual, isn't it? Even in EEOC cases, that's unusual?
I do not try any EEOC cases, Your Honor. I only handle its appeals, but this is my first time encountering such a situation.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Was anything additional presented to the trial judge post-verdict?
No, Your Honor. It was actually a reiteration of everything that was presented to him during the motion in eliminates, as well as what was presented to the jury during the course of the trial. And that was primarily the fact that Flip Mia Stack exercised significant control over the victims and the IHOP employees.
That's a question of fact, is it not?
Was it a question of fact whether Flip Mia Stack exercised control?
Oh.
That could be a question of fact, Your Honor, and that's why the facts are in the record that support the finding that the district court reached.
But it's a question of fact that's peculiarly that of the jury, isn't it? Not that of the judge.
Your Honor, I totally agree with you. I cannot speak to why the judge decided to make this ruling post-verdict. But what I can speak to is the fact that the record before the jury and prior to the jury contained substantial factual information, a lot of it, which was presented.
It would have been enough for the jury to rule on it had
they ruled on it. Absolutely, Your Honor.
They didn't rule on it.
That is true. The information that was presented to the jury largely.
Why didn't the jury address this? Your adversary said two things. One, that this came as a complete surprise to everybody. The judge raised the issue on his own. Your adversary also said that the parties had agreed that the judge would resolve this question. These two are completely incompatible. Which of these do you think is the correct one? Or is it a third, that the parties wanted this submitted to the jury, but the judge insisted on deciding it himself?
It was the final, Your Honor. The parties wanted it, submitted it to the jury. The judge decided to resolve it himself. However, the jury still heard all of the facts undergirding Flip Mia Stack's liability.
Whether the jury heard something, if they weren't allowed to rule on it.
The issue of employer control, Your Honor, was resolved on the facts as presented to the jury and to the judge. First, in the form of.
But resolved by the judge. By the
I think we're clear on that.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah,
so.
It doesn't make any difference when it was presented to the jury. They didn't get the rule on it.
So the jury decided the issue of sexual harassment, and
yes,
then the judge decided who is responsible.
That is correct, Your Honor, because from the complaint stage going forward, the.
And you don't know why that is.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Why that happened.
That is correct. And from the point of the complaint going forward.
The district judge never explained his decision, or you just don't know what the judge said?
The district court did not explain it.
Explained his decision.
To resolve this issue.
Normally, district judges like to have juries decide as many questions as they can.
This is true. And since this is a scenario where we're dealing, as opponent's counsel explained, with a little different scenario with these three entities, the judge probably decided it was more appropriate for him to resolve this. I think the outcome would have been the same whether the jury or the judge decided it, because the facts revealed that Flitmeerstadt exercised significant control over the IHOP employees and the victims in particular. As this court has recognized in EEOC versus Illinois, hiring and firing authority is a key component of an employer-employee relationship. And Flitmeerstadt exercised substantial hiring and firing authority through its district managers, who were direct employees of Flitmeerstadt. Although Sal John Muhammad, the sole shareholder and president and owner of the Racine IHOP and MHR, were the nominal employees of the victim, they testified they had, Mr. John Muhammad testified he had no input in the personnel or operations of the 21 IHOPs. Those, in fact, had been substantially and fully delegated to Flitmeerstadt, making Flitmeerstadt more than just a consultant, as this panel has already observed. It is also undisputed that Flitmeerstadt exercised total control over IHOP's employees' compensation rates, their raises, and their bonuses. But most importantly, Flitmeerstadt was responsible for the prevention of sexual harassment in the IHOP setting, and thus had an independent duty to protect those employees. Flitmeerstadt created and implemented the anti-harassment policy that controlled the protections of these employees. Yet Flitmeerstadt also kept that policy locked in a cabinet. The complaint procedure, which was created by Flitmeerstadt, was not available in writing to the employees. It was only presented in a video when they first were hired during a new employee orientation. But otherwise, it was not available. It was not posted where employees could learn how to go about complaining. Notwithstanding the fact our two victims did remember that they could have complain if they experienced sexual harassment to any manager, and did so to three managers: Mr. Gutierrez, the assistant manager, who was also the harasser; Ms. Del Rio, assistant manager, who refused to report the complaints because she did not take them seriously; and to Ms. Michelle Dahl, who was the general manager. All of these people were hired or relocated by Flitmeerstadt's district manager to this Racine IHOP, therefore indicating further control over the operations and personnel that worked at this particular IHOP. The other thing is that Flitmeerstadt's district manager, Smith, he executed the termination of Ms. Dahl with the approval of Flitmeerstadt's president, Mrs. John Muhammad. And as Flitmeerstadt continues to maintain, while on the one hand it says the district manager was only at the premises two times in a course of a month, it also maintains that Mr. Smith is the go-to guy for sexual harassment, something that the policy does not support, but they can't have it both ways. Either Flitmeerstadt is directly involved in this process and is the central entity controlling this process, or it isn't. And based on their own testimony of the president of Flitmeerstadt and Mr. Smith, they are centrally involved. Under Tamayo versus Blagojevich, this court has ruled that if in an employee in an Equal Pay Act case, that where the entity controls the policy that undergirds the violation, that entity is a proper defendant in a Title VII liability suit. That is this case where here Flitmeerstadt controlled the policy that governed these operations, and it was the ineffectiveness of that policy and the complaint procedures and the reporting procedures that led to the continuous harassment of Ms. Schisler and Ms. Powell. With respect to clarifying something that the opposing counsel said earlier.
Counsel, I'm puzzled by this line of argument that somebody who designs the complaint procedure must be personally liable. Suppose Joe Blow had designed the complaint procedure and Management Hospitality had implemented Joe Blow's design. Would that make Joe Blow personally liable if the procedure doesn't work?
No,
the statute,
Your Honor,
says the liable person must be the employer. It wouldn't make Joe Blow the employer.
No, Your Honor. And that's why the district court...
Then I'm lost by why you're saying FlipMeAStack designed the procedure, therefore it must be liable.
As a defendant.
I thought the question was whether FlipMeAStack was a joint employer.
Okay.
Not whether it designed the complaint procedure. Now, it may have done a bunch of things, including designing the complaint procedure. But unless it's a joint employer, unless I'm seriously misunderstanding the way Title VII works, it's not liable.
Your Honor, it is liable in this instance under, as EEOC versus Illinois indicated, it exercised significant control over the employment relationship of Ms. Schisler and Ms. Powell, as I stated earlier, because of its hiring and firing authority, because of its impact on...
Let's go back to my Joe Blow example. The managers of a firm exercise a lot of authority over the way in which the firm works, but the managers aren't liable under Title VII because they're not the employer. What, in your view, is it that makes FlipMeAStack a joint employer?
In my view, what makes FlipMeAStack a joint employer is that the nominal employers, MHR and Sal Jah Mohammed, had absolutely nothing to do with the IHOP employees beyond funding their salaries. Everything else was handled by FlipMeAStack. Every aspect, HR, workers' compensation, bonuses, raises, personnel policies, operational policies, marketing, promotion, every aspect of those IHOPs were run, managed, and organized and coordinated by FlipMeAStack. And if, in fact, the other two entities are doing absolutely nothing and FlipMeAStack is doing everything else, this court would find that it is a de facto employer of these employees and that it would be covered under Title VII because that significant exercise of control over those employees would allow those employees to be counted. And those employees, during the time frame of the sexual harassment, was 500 to 700 employees, which would clearly put the FlipMeAStack in the purview of Title VII, which only requires 15 employees or more to be covered. Then, with respect to why FlipMeAStack should be held directly accountable for the sexual harassment, we also look at the fact that it was FlipMeAstack's policies and procedures which were ineffectively enforced by the managers it hired, trained, and organized to follow through on its policies at issue. And it's those failings that directly resulted in these two teenagers being victims of the sexual harassment. And so for that reason, we do believe that the district court's determination of that FlipMeAStack was liable should be upheld. Under piercing the corporate veil theory, which we did press below, as well, there's also the economic intermingling of FlipMeAStack, MHR, and Mr. Jah Mohammed as employers. In one of the facts that came forth is that when...
I'm quite perplexed by this argument about piercing the corporate veil. That doesn't have anything to do with federal law or with joint employer status. That's a state law doctrine. And your brief, of course, doesn't discuss Wisconsin law. Right? The Supreme Court said in Best Foods that on piercing theories, even when the claim arises under federal law, liability depends on state law. So what is it about Wisconsin law that you're relying on here?
Nothing at all, Your Honor. We're
nothing
completely
so
relying
no
on federal law.
Trying to talk over a question won't help you.
Okay.
That if you're not relying on Wisconsin law, you can't have any kind of piercing the corporate veil theory. That's just a straightforward consequence of Best Foods.
Your Honor, in Papa versus Katie Industries, they recognize piercing the corporate veil. And
Best Foods is a more recent decision. It's a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court, and we tend to follow those decisions.
Okay. And with respect to multiple entities, the Papa decision recognizes, as does Worth versus Tire, that multiple entities can be considered employers, and that and in Papa, one principle that still comes out beyond piercing the corporate veil is that affiliated corporations can be held independently liable for violations of the statute, particularly with civil rights.
Was that an issue that you had to prove?
I'm sorry.
Was that an issue you had to prove?
That FlipMeAStack was liable?
No, the issues that led to what you could describe as the piercing of the corporate veil, the issues that who was in charge? Is that an issue that is the burden of the EEOC?
who was an employer was an issue of the EEOC.
Is that an issue presented to the jury?
In the same manner as everything else, the facts were supported to the jury. The facts through testimony.
Was it presented to the jury, and did they rule on it?
No.
They ruled on it?
No.
No.
The facts were presented to the jury via testimony, largely presented by the defendants, as to who were employers, what they controlled, what they operated, where they had input, and all of this was presented. The fact that the jury did not get to rule on this was a decision of the district court. But I want to clarify that at no point in time can the defendants maintain they were blindsided and not capable of putting in evidence, when in fact a lot of the evidence that was put in on which the district court judge relied was information that was presented by Mr. and Mrs. John Muhammad. It was Mrs. John Muhammad that said, if it weren't for the IHOPs, Flip Me a Stack would not have a need to exist. It was Mrs. John Muhammad, who's the president of Flip Me a Stack, that said that Mr. John Muhammad had no input in the operation and personnel policies of this particular of the corporations, of the IHOPs, of the management of the IHOPs and their employees. It was Mr. John Muhammad that said, I don't know what goes on. I just delegate this to my wife, and she handles it from there. I also want to clarify, the EEOC never presented an argument of integrated enterprise. We recognized that this circuit had already abandoned that theory in PAPA, and thus we would not have been relying on that to present a reason for why we felt all three entities should be considered employers. Instead, we presented facts that supported why each of those entities, and in particular Flip Me a Stack, should be held should be considered an employer under Title VII and held accountable for the sexual harassment. If appropriate, I'd like to move on to the punitive damages claim. Again, as with the affirmative defense, the defendants can't meet its burden of showing good faith or affirmative defense because with respect to the affirmative defense, the victims did complain to three managers. Victoria John Muhammad herself said that that was compliant with their policy, and that being a second prong under the affirmative defense.
Was presented to the jury, was it not?
I'm sorry?
The affirmative defense was presented.
That is correct,
jury,
Your Honor.
Was it not? Well, I have the same reaction to your argument as I had to your adversaries. We're not the jury. You need to cast your argument in terms of the standard of review, not what we would do as an original matter.
Right. And the standard of review is that the defendants must establish that no rational jury could have found for the EEOC, and we are saying they cannot meet that burden on these facts. And that is because these facts clearly support the jury's verdict of liability, because it's undisputed that they were subjected to severe and pervasive harassment and that they complained in compliance with the established sexual harassment policy. We also maintain that the award of $100,000, punitive damages awards of $100,000 to Ms. Powell was appropriate, because if this court accepts our view that Flip Me a Stack is an employer of the 500 to 700 employees it managed, that is more than sufficient to support the damages exposure, where the statutory cap was $200,000 and the jury awarded $100,000. Finally, as to the special verdict, this court has recognized, as long as the jury instructions were appropriate and not misleading, and that is a point that the defendants concede, it is within the district court's discretion as to whether to add additional questions to the verdict. This court entertained the affirmative defense and presented it to the jury via the jury instructions, which the defendants concede were correct. And so we find no basis for overturning the jury's instructions on that basis.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further?
Yes, Your Honor. To be clear, Judge Easterbrook, I want to point out that we were not surprised that the district court judge was going to be deciding the issue of liability of Flip Me a Stack post-trial. That was not a surprise. What was a surprise was the theory that the judge had decided under the control test. That was a surprise because it had never been pled or argued by the EEOC, who framed the issue of liability of Flipping Stack pre-trial and then post-trial. And they could have objected to this process, but they didn't. So the issue was framed as one of integrated enterprise and Papa versus Katie.
Now, I do want to understand how it was that the issue didn't go to the jury. You said during your argument that it didn't go to the jury because the parties wanted it not to go to the jury. Now, your adversary said during her argument that both parties wanted it to go to the jury, and the judge, for unstated reasons, kept it away from the jury. These two things can't both be true. So which one is true?
What is true is that is our version. What happened, Your Honor, is
what
that...
What is your version?
Okay. What happened is the judge asked, what is the theory of liability of Flipping Stack during a scheduling conference? And he said, I'd like you to brief this issue, EEOC. So pre-trial, the EEOC filed its motions in limine on corporate liability, outlining its theory and asked actually for judgment against Flipping Stack pre-trial. If you'll see that, the brief is crystal clear. It was based upon Papa versus Katie.
Summary judgment?
That's what they were seeking. We pointed out in an opposition in a, you know, a short brief basically saying, look, under piercing the corporate veil.
Summary judgment was denied.
Well, they couched it as seeking judgment in a motion in limine. Well,
if he's going to do it by himself, it's summary judgment.
I agree. Well, and that's what I pointed
so
that out.
Pause with me for a minute.
Yes.
The summary judgment motion, assuming that what we're talking about is a summary judgment, was denied. He did not rule on it. Therefore, it was denied.
Yes.
He did not grant it. But then he did not present that matter to the jury.
Correct.
Okay, I got it where and, we are, but I don't know why.
But I still don't know the answer to the question whether he kept it away from the jury because the parties jointly wanted him to keep it away from the jury. Because he wanted it kept away from the jury, even though both sides wanted it presented to the jury, or something else.
Well, procedurally what occurred is we filed a brief in opposition to their motion saying, under piercing the corporate veil, that is reserved for the judge to determine. So what the judge said is...
That would be after judgment.
Right. And so he said, I'm gonna wait till after the trial to make this decision about Flipping Stack.
Was there any objection made to that, or did you agree?
We didn't object. Because we understood that they were proceeding.
Well, that
proceeding.
Means you agreed.
We agreed. Because they were proceeding under Papa versus Katie.
How can you complain about the trial judge then making a ruling on this if there's no objection to him exercising?
You're right. We agreed because they were proceeding under Papa versus Katie, a theory that we believe we would win on. And had we had any idea that the control test would be established,
how
we may have had a number of
reactions. How is this different from the pleadings conforming to the evidence? I mean, if all parties consent that they'll allow the pleadings to conform to the evidence, then it doesn't necessarily have to be pled.
Well, it wasn't pled and it wasn't briefed. They set out their game plan pre-trial that it was strictly Papa versus Katie. We had no idea that they'd be arguing.
This is only on the issue of the merger of the liability, that is the piercing of the corporal veil.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat that?
This is only on the issue of the piercing of the corporate veil that you're talking about?
Yes. It was strictly on the issue of...
So it had nothing to do with an issue of the liability or what the EEOC had to prove in its initial case?
Correct. It was strictly on the issue of the liability of Flipping Stack.
What did they have to prove on their initial case that was not presented to the jury because the judge hugged it to his own bosom?
They'd have to establish a reason why Flipping Stack was liable for sexual harassment at one of its client restaurants. And as... You've pointed out, Judge Easterbrook, just because you've written a policy doesn't mean you can be held liable for sexual harassment. Law firms do this all the time. It doesn't make them liable if the policy is not carried out.
I still don't know what happened down there, but you're
right.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Ken.
Thank you.
Case will be taken under advisement.